Everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have some great guests coming on today that I want to introduce to you, and I'll tell you more about them in a little while. But Rahul Mehra and John Ubaldo are co-founders of an organization called Ag Familia, which is a co-op of farms working together in New York across thousands of acres, providing good, clean, and locally produced food and hemp, and I'll tell you more about them when they come in on. But first, I want to share some things going on in and around the news with you, and of course, share my weekly recipe. So the courts have been very busy these last couple of weeks. You know, we've had some liberal things coming out of the courts, also some conservative things coming out of the courts, but I was really happy to share with you that three pipelines were interrupted this week due to courts. One is the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which is a pipeline, a 600-mile pipeline that was going to move frack gas from West Virginia through Virginia into North Carolina. And it would have disproportionately harmed African-American and indigenous communities all along its proposed route. And there's right now 30,000 indigenous people living in the projected area where this pipeline was going to be, including, and this project also included building an enormous fracked gas compressor station in Union Hill, which is an African-American community that has a lot of historical significance and cultural significance in Virginia. So anyway, they were not able to prove that they were not going to have a negative impact on the environment. So they were, so actually the company involved in putting that pipeline together actually pulled it, and they just knew that they were not going to be able to move forward. So that one is dead. Then on Monday morning, a federal judge ordered the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is the protest that's been going on for years on indigenous land out in Dakota, that has been finally put a halt to that because it was not meeting the safeguards that are necessary. And then also the Keystone Pipeline, which is the crude oil that was going to come from Canada, British Columbia, all the way through more indigenous land and through parts of the Midwest all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, and all that oil was actually also going to be exported. It wasn't even for this country. Anyway, they also put a halt on that. There already was a stay, and they just voted to keep this stay in place. So that's all really, really great things. You know, we have some great grassroots organizations that have been working really hard to make all that happen. Friends of the Earth, Climate Hawks Vote, Earth Justice, 350.org, Food and Water Watch, all these great grassroots organizations that all need our support. But I just want to thank everybody that has responded to my calls for writing letters and signing petitions all these years to close down these pipelines. But we have to keep it going. There's still the Williams Pipeline here in New York. That's the one that I've been writing about a lot. It goes from Pennsylvania through New Jersey, through to Staten Island, across New York Harbor to the Rockaways and Long Beach, and it's just horribly placed. It has so much potential for doing damage, not just to the environment and to commerce and tourism, but to the health of New Yorkers. Plus, of course, it is a target for terrorist acts as well. So it's just bad to have anything that dangerous so close to New York City where millions of people live. So Governor Cuomo has denied permits for this pipeline at least three times that I'm aware of. It could be more. But now, supposedly, they're meeting behind closed doors with National Grid. And we just want some transparency. We want to know what's going on behind those closed doors. So please sign the petition I have on my website at iegreen.com. If you don't get my newsletter, you can sign up on my website for my weekly newsletter, which will tell you who my guests are and of course, highlight all these petitions and things going on that I want you to participate in. Another one is to tell Bayer, formerly Monsanto, that we want to get these beekeeping pesticides off of the market. All these neonicotinoids that are responsible for much of the bee decline are still being marketed, and we need to get them off the market. We need our bees. 40% of the bee population has died in this past year alone. We're really losing our bees, and they're responsible for so much of our food supply. I think they said 1 out of every 3 bites of our food is a result of bee pollinators. So we really need our bees, because if we lose our bees, we will lose a lot of our food. So please sign that petition. It's a simple thing to do, and you can feel the power that these biotech companies have on our government, and it's just not good. We really need to separate this. We really need to get corporations out of counting like people, and Citizens United, we need to reverse that, which is responsible for so much of this power and lobbying that that corporations have over the power of our government. So, and we just have, the current administration just keeps doing one horrible thing after the next. Education is really, really being harassed right now, being forced to open in September, whether it's safe or not. He's mandating that schools have to open or they'll lose funding. And he's also made a rule that all foreign students in universities who have visas to study here, if their universities are online, they need to self-deport themselves. They need to leave the country, and that is just unacceptable. I heard that Harvard and MIT are actually suing the government, but who knows what will happen. It's just, we are just in such a bad state in this country right now with the current administration. All we can do is work hard to get this administration out. So, send letters to people in states that can make a difference. There's petitions to try to undo the Electoral College so that, if the popular vote votes for a Democrat, that's who gets elected. The fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote and we ended up with this moron in the White House is just not okay. So, but that's a whole nother issue, and I don't want to go there. So where I do want to go, though, is to share with you my weekly recipe. And I have to tell you, we had a barbecue this weekend. First time I had actually 4 other couples here, and we did a vegetarian burger taste test. I bought Dr. Prager's veggie burgers, which are, regular standard. They're the ones that, that are easily accessible everywhere. Then I also bought Beyond Burgers, which I had not tried yet, but I've heard people loving them, saying that they taste so much like a real burger, not that I'm really looking to taste a real burger. And then Trader Joe's makes a veggie burger that is like a Beyond Burger. It's, a fresh burger, not a frozen burger, in the dairy section. So we had those. And then I made my own veggie burgers. And so we did taste tests, and I have to say, my veggie burgers won hand down. I did not include the Impossible Burger because the Impossible Burger is genetically modified or has many genetically modified ingredients. So we did not include that one. But I want to share these veggie burgers with you. I baked them in the oven, and then I froze them so that I could easily put them right onto the grill when my company was here, and I didn't have to worry about them being mushy or sticking to the grill or anything. And so it worked really well. So this recipe made 14 burgers. So you want to start with, I'll first read the ingredients to you. 1 tablespoon of ground flaxseed, 1 tablespoon water, 2 tablespoons olive oil, 1 onion chopped, 2 carrots chopped, 4 teaspoons plus 1 tablespoon chopped garlic, 2 stalks of celery chopped, 1/2 a yellow pepper chopped and 1/2 a red pepper chopped, And that's just because I like color in it. I mean, if you only have one pepper and it's a green pepper, go for it. That's fine. But I just like the little sparkles of color in there. One sweet potato that was cooked and I mashed it. 1 1/4 cups of mushrooms chopped. 1/2 cup of cooked beets. 2 tablespoons plus another 2 tablespoons of tamari. 2 tablespoons of sherry. 2 tablespoons fresh chopped parsley. 2 tablespoons of moringa powder. Now this I put in for extra iron, fiber, and calcium. Each tablespoon has like the equivalent of 2 cups of kale. So I had bought this organic moringa powder at Costco a while ago and have never used it. So I thought, oh, I'll just put this in here. So that's why I had it in there. If you don't have it, you can leave it out, and that I'm sure the recipe will still work fine, but it just adds extra bang. You can also just put in some fresh kale if you have some that you might want to cook first. And then 2 cups of cooked short grain brown rice, 1/2 cup of ground walnuts, and 1/3 cup of ground gluten-free oats, 3 tablespoons nutritional yeast, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1 teaspoon thyme, 2 tablespoons of potato starch, 1 tablespoon herbs de Provence, which is a spice mix that you can find pretty much anywhere, 1/4 cup of sesame seeds, and 1/4 cup of gluten-free breadcrumbs. So in a small bowl, I mix the tablespoon of ground flaxseed with 1 tablespoon of water, and I just set that aside. And that's a typical recipe for an egg substitute, 1 tablespoon flaxseed to 1 tablespoon of water or apple cider vinegar. Either works, but it becomes glutinous and helps hold things together the way an egg would. So you're going to saute the onions in the olive oil until they're translucent, add celery and carrots, and 4 teaspoons of chopped garlic. Add the peppers and continue cooking until soft. If things start sticking, you can add 1 tablespoon at a time of water to the wok or pan that you're sauteing in. And just cook all the vegetables until they're soft. And then transfer them to a food processor. You can add the cooked beets to the food processor as well. Using the same pan, I'm now going to saute the mushrooms. So I took everything out of the pan, added some more oil to the saute pan, let the oil get hot, and then add the mushrooms along with the other tablespoon of garlic. And when the mushrooms started to get soft, I added the sherry, 2 tablespoons of sherry, and 2 tablespoons of tamari. And you want to cook that until the water absorbs, and so that the mushrooms actually get a little crispy and seared, and they're delicious, and they will add a lot of umami flavor to the vegetables. So that's the idea by cooking the mushrooms separately. Then you're going to add those seared, delicious tamari mushrooms into the food processor, and you're going to pulse all the vegetables together until they're coarsely chopped. You don't want to make them a puree, but you want them coarsely chopped. Then in a large mixing bowl, you're going to combine the rice, the chopped vegetables, the parsley, the flaxseed mixture, the mashed sweet potato, the moringa powder, the ground walnuts and oats, the nutritional yeast, the potato starch, and the herbs. All together and mix it all up. Then you're going to make, I used a pie pan. I made a mixture with the sesame seeds and the gluten-free breadcrumbs. And I then formed the mixture into patties, and I dipped each patty into the sesame breadcrumb mixture. So that just makes the coating, the outside a little bit drier. And then I laid them out on a greased cookie sheet that I lined with parchment paper, and then I sprayed the parchment paper with just a little bit of olive oil. And I baked it in a 375-degree oven for 20 minutes. Then I removed the pan and turned all of the burgers over and cooked it for another 10 minutes. And everyone's oven is different, so just keep an eye on it. You can also saute them in a pan if you would like. I did that as well and tried them that way. But this, baking them in the oven keeps the oil content down and dries them out a little bit more, which is actually good for them holding together. And then I freeze the cooked patties, like I said, and I pulled them out and them right onto the grill. I sprayed the grill with a little oil, and I cooked them on the grill. And then also, Mayoka, who makes wonderful cheese, she makes the mozzarella cheese, and I have her book. That's how I learned to make my cashew chev cheese. She now has vegan cheddar slices that were just so good. I mean, I haven't had anything that has come close to cheddar cheese in a long time, but I put a slice of the vegan cheddar cheese on. I put pickles, tomatoes, microgreens, and it was just so great. I made a spicy ketchup with some a little vegan mayo, some ketchup, and some sriracha sauce. I even added some hot chili peppers into that, and that was a sauce that I served on the side. And they were just so good. So I hope you make them. Please give me some feedback if you do. I always love hearing about my recipes that people make and get the feedback. So enjoy. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my two guests, Rahul Mehra and John Ubaldo. They are the co-founders of Ag Familia. And Ag Familia is a co-op of farms that are working together in New York across thousands of acres, providing a source of good, clean food and locally produced hemp while supporting families and rural communities. They have built and supported an organic and non-GMO zone of family-run farms that have zero inputs of chemical pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers, and they all work together cooperatively to protect families, our soil, and our environment. Rahul is also an advisor, investor, and serial entrepreneur. He's bringing over 25 years of executive experience to the table, and he's been a founder, board member, and senior executive in many companies related to ecotech, personalized wellness, biotech, big data analytics, and more. And he's focused on opportunities that affect positive change and strengthen our social cohesion, personal health, and environmental well-being. And John Ubaldo is also a co-founder of Ag Familia, and he's one of the co-op farmers. Prior to starting his farm 17 years ago, he was an investment banker on Wall Street. And as owner and operator of John Boy's Farm, he raises Berkshire pigs, Black Angus cattle, chickens, ducks, and geese. And his farm is 100% biodynamic with zero chemical inputs. He also has a retail space in Bedford, New York called The Outpost, and is the founder and chief operating officer of the August West Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture, which helps small farms grow organically and compete in the marketplace. And he spent the last 12 years helping small farms get established and thrive. So it's my pleasure to introduce both of these men to all of you. Are you on with me?
We are. Sure are.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. Before we really get deep into the show, maybe you both could share with us where the idea for Ag Familia came from. What was the inspiration behind it?
Okay. Well, you're better at that one.
Well, what's that?
You've always been better at that one.
So John and I have been friends for a number of years now, and he was over for dinner one night, and we're drinking a bottle of wine, and he told me that, half of the family farms in New York State were going to disappear in the next 10 years. And so that was the germination to say, hey, let's try and figure this out. And as we looked at it, you know, John has selflessly been working with family farms up in Washington County for years. And he really had already established a co-op system. And he was effectively on a volunteer basis helping them to get grains in the ground, specific grains in the ground that were then getting collected and processed by a processor for feed. And so when we took a little closer look at this, we saw that that was, you know, essentially a foundation for a business in the sense that it could make enough money that you could give it back to all of these family farms and administrate in such a way that you could grow into a large acreage of very diversified crops and do very specific things for niche clients. And, you know, from that, these family farms who have essentially been dairy farmers, they could focus on their dairy farming. They could focus on what they've been doing for generations, but they'd have this, you know, they have lots and lots of land that really hasn't been impacted by chemicals. And so they could essentially grow specified crops that we would take control of for them and sell off. And that's a foundation on which they can kind of rest their family and their well-being. And if they have well-being, it means that the rural communities have well-being because the family farm is the essence of the rural community and the culture out there.
Uh-huh. So what's unique about the structure? Are you saying that the cooperative uses different farmers' land, but it's all run by your organization, all the grains?
Well, so the farms are all individually owned and operated.
Yeah.
And
okay. I think the uniqueness of the structure is the lack.
What?
I said one at a time, so I can hear you.
Go ahead, John.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's hard to hear you, Raul. So I think that the uniqueness of the structure is really the lack of uniqueness for the structure, and that this is what was used in America for well over 100 years until big companies came in and started putting all of these businesses together. So where you had a model where just about every town had a mill and a distribution center that the farmer was able to sell to or could go to the next town or could find a buyer, they would go in, big companies go in, they buy these co-ops up, destroy them, and move everything 1,000 miles away. So that farmer is now at the will of the only buyer that's around for 1,000 miles. So what we're doing is reestablishing the old existing co-op model that helps small farms find a marketplace and have the ability to be able to predict their future and to just put this old model back in place. So we're not doing anything that is necessarily unique. We're doing what was proven for years to help farms, added with Raul's side, which is more tech and corporate oriented, to increase our distribution and increase our ability to add on farms at a just much greater scalable level.
Uh-huh. And how many farms are part of your cooperative?
All right.
Maybe the engineer will get him back. So why don't you tell me, how many farms are part of your cooperative?
Yeah, so currently what we had decided we were going to do initially was bring in, a larger number of farms. So John, under the foundation, at one point in time had 30 farms and 3,000 acres under management. And, you know, with the result of COVID and with, the lack of transparency about what was going to be happening over the course of the rest of this year, we decided that we needed to start smaller, ensure that we could support the way we were hoping that we could. And so we're essentially at around 10 farms right now. And that's plus or minus, and that's why I wanted John to take the question, because, it's kind of in flux. We're adding some veggie guys, we've got a couple of meat guys, and then there's a four or five that are on the hemp side, and so it's a little bit in flux. But we're essentially at around 10 farms and 1,000 acres right now. We've got the wait list for the rest of the 30 that we hope to bring in next year. And then we've got, kind of waiting and seeing, watching in the wings, another 50 farms, around 5,000 acres in total. And what makes that really exciting is that, at least
for me from an operational perspective is that, you know, we're very closely knit. So even at 30 farms, everyone's within like 20 miles of each other. And so operationally, you can really support each other. And remember, the underlying concept of the co-op is everyone's got their own land. They've got equipment. They've got trucks. They've got expertise. And so everybody's supporting each other at harvest time, at planting time, and in between, you know, with education and whatever support different guys need. And so that keeps you really, really efficient, and that's part of why, you know, we're able to be very nimble and compete with the bigger industrial players.
Uh-huh. And so, Raul, did you have to set up a new processing plant in Washington County?
Yeah, so, again, because of the situation this year, we've pushed out the plan on the processing facility for next year. But what we have in place currently is a number of farm acres, and then we've got a distribution center through which we are able to, collect as well as move product out. And then next year, our intention is to have in place the milling capability that John was referring to previously, and we're even looking at, additional processing capabilities moving into the future. But even, you know, these milling and processing capabilities are also essentially, family operated and run, right? So I'll give you the example of the slaughterhouse that John uses. Sorry for all the vegetarians out there, but the slaughterhouse that John uses for his herds on his farm. It's family operated. They take a maximum, I believe, of 12 animals a week in an entire week. And so they take the animal, you know, almost one at a time, two at a time. They take them overnight, keep them so that they're calm. It's an entirely different way of approaching the business. And so to create the efficiencies off of that, to do this in a low-impact, sustainable way that is, you know, we all have different ideologies, vegetarian or not, but if we're looking at people doing that, you know, eating meat as an example, this is as low an impact way as I've been able to find out there and as kind a way to do this.
Uh-huh. Wow. Yeah, it seems like 12 animals per week would be hard to actually, for it to be profitable.
Yeah, well, you know, what happens is that it's obviously more expensive than going to Tyson's and you got a million chickens a minute. That's definitely the case. And the other thing that people have to start to think about is how they look at their plate, right? There was a time that when I was a kid, you look at your plate and people were eating a porterhouse or a very large piece of meat by themselves. And, you know, people need to think about grains and vegetables and a lot of other things on that plate. And that meat is something that's, you know, it's shared. It's something that is not, you know, the full center of the plate, right?
Absolutely.
So that, you know, those are the ideas.
Uh-huh. So, John, this is for you. What inspired you to leave Wall Street and start a farm for 17 years ago? What was your inspiration?
It was something I always wanted to do as a kid. It was kind of my goal when I went to Wall Street. But my brother is a chef, and we went around, and he turned me on to the Berkshire pigs. And the more that I learned about them and their history and the quality of their meat, and they're a little bit tougher to raise than other pigs, I just kind of got hooked on the idea of establishing, you know, this breed in the Northeast.
Are there not other people doing it as well?
There are people, but most don't raise Berkshires.
Berkshires aren't big litter pigs, and I am also probably the only farmer in the Northeast that has English blood in my herd that kind of came on a fluke from the University of Iowa. They don't let regular farmers do it. It's more of a research thing, but I wanted those old lines and I wanted those old genetics in my herd. But Berkshire pork is not, you know, is not anywhere near top 5% of anywhere near 5% of pork produced in the U.S.
And do you work with NOFA New York as well with your organic farm? Are you a member of NOFA?
Listen, this is very, you know, I'm a little bit of a renegade when it comes to this stuff, and I have my own visions of organic and what organic is. And just to be honest with you, organic farming employs too much chemicals than I wanted. Biodynamic farming is chemical-free. So my push was not for the certification, but for my own purposes to produce the highest quality, most nutritiously dense meats that you could buy. So I do work with them, but I don't, my farm is not certified organic. And, you know, like I said, we employ no chemicals ever, and organic farming, especially on a commercial scale, is very heavily chemically intensive, which was not anything I wanted to touch.
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with biodynamic. I don't know if you looked at my bio, but I'm a Waldorf teacher, or I was, and so I did a little study with biodynamics and up at the Pfeiffer Center and stuff. So, and actually, as a matter of fact, I have the gardening teacher from the Waldorf School coming here this afternoon. We're doing a compost treatment, biodynamic compost treatment for my big compost pile today. So,
it's a matter of knowledge, and you have
familiar with it, and certainly love biodynamics. It's, you know, it's like I call it organic on steroids.
Yeah, it was the organic like organic was in the '70s.
Yeah. So you've been doing it for 17 years, and do you also grow vegetables, or you pretty much just do pigs and cattle and chickens and ducks and geese?
Well, I used to grow vegetables, but as I got older and didn't have that much time to be on my hands and knees, what I did, and my whole approach to this has always been like, we don't need one big me. We need 10,000 small me's. So over the course of the past 8 years, I've helped about four or five young couples get established growing vegetables. So now we have four more farms that, I hate to say it, but they probably are better growers than I am. And I thought that was better way to go. And, you know, I do a lot of crops, which is time consuming because we grind all our feed and everything weekly, et cetera, et cetera. I just found it was better to my time to focus on helping getting some more younger people into the business.
Yeah. Well, that's been something that I've been trying to raise awareness on is land access for these young farmers, because that seems to be one of the biggest challenges for young farmers is to actually find land and to work land. Do you have farmers that are, or people that are sharing land or leasing land to young farmers? Is that part of your program?
The four that I worked with started out on land leasing it, and they have all four since bought their own property. And one of them right up the road from me is actually just finally moving out of the trailer they've been living in to a house that they built. So, you know, these are little success stories that really have a huge impact, you know, on a small local-based economy.
Absolutely. And where are your farms located? I know you said Washington County. Can you, where exactly is Washington County?
Washington County is up on the Vermont border. We could basically throw a rock into Manchester, Vermont, if that's any decent of a landmark. But we are in towns like Greenwich, New York, Cambridge, New York, Salem, Easton, hilly area with some decently rocky soil, and, you know, a ton of struggling dairy farms, which really opens up a huge opportunity for, you know, us to keep them around by helping them diversify.
Yeah, so you, Raul, maybe this is good for you. You actually have set up this model so that the growing of the grains ends up being more of the bread and butter or the stability of the farm. Is that your goal? And then the dairy is the cream on top kind of thing?
Well, I think you're going to find that. Oh, is this you, Raul?
No, go ahead. I'm fine.
I think you're going to find that because I started doing the grain with my foundation that is fairly established, and, you know, dairy farmers are some of the best grain growers there are out there. And then I think as you begin to layer in, that was just the more established part of it. I think ultimately that the vegetable business and livestock business is going to have a bigger and bigger impact as we begin to grow those out. But I started with the crops because it was really a matter of trying to clean up as much land as we could while carbon sequestering in the process, while ultimately creating that diversification for the dairy farmer.
Yeah, because I know a lot of the dairy farmers, you know, are really struggling. You know, that model that, Raul, that you had explained with the grain and the mills being moved thousands of miles away, it's been the same model for the dairy farmers, right? That we have these conglomerates that are now, you know, like, you know, that like Horizon Milk, for instance, you know, that have bought up all the small dairy farms or, you know, the processing plants, and now all the dairy farmers don't really have much choice in the markets. They kind of like have to sell to the one buyer type of thing. Is that what you're finding?
Yeah, you know, that's definitely what we're trying to compete against. And I think, you know, John made a really fundamental statement, which was that, you know, essentially when you think about this as the family farms, when you think about this as local communities working together, the advantage it gives us over the industrial farms or even the industrialized cooperatives that are basically held hostage to a single outlet is that we can move very nimbly. We can move as per the requirement of a niche client, right? So, and we can also do smaller numbers of acreage for a specific crop, and it still makes sense for us. So our economies are totally different, right? And because we're supporting each other with the cost structures, with the expenses, the underlying expenses, it's affordable for us to do that. And because we're doing all biodynamic crops, essentially, we get a better price in the marketplace that gets distributed back into the entire farming community, and just the resilience starts to build off of itself. And that's essentially the model, right? So it's nothing, as John said, it's not like, you know, we're reinventing the wheel. We're going back to, you know, what built this country.
And do your farms share equipment? Or does everyone really own their own equipment?
John can speak to that better, but they do share, yeah.
I mean, one one combine is a $450,000 to $500,000 investment. And so to have somebody who is using that, that we could pay rent to for them to using, it helps them pay. We're not making a $450,000 investment, and it goes all the way down to trucking, you know, and otherwise by sharing in that. One of our farmers is purchasing a hemp baler, which is a $250,000 investment. He would not be able to do that if we weren't going to be sharing in the use and, you know, and costs of it. And, you know, I just wanted to back up on, you know, one more thing. You know, COVID has really exposed our food system. And a lot of Americans got to see firsthand how food is produced in this country. And I think they were very, very scared by what they saw, to the point where you're now seeing Congress actually begin to float some bills on reining in, you know, reining in these factory farms. 90% of our meat is processed by four companies in this country. And that is just, the farmer is no longer an entrepreneur. A farmer is basically an indentured servant. Like, if my farm didn't have its independence and I was dependent on outside sources to sell my stuff, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. So I think empowering these people to be entrepreneurs again and get their brains working is really, really, like, this has so many impacts, from just nourishing people on down to nourishing the farmer himself, who's like, you know, this downtrodden, negatively perceived person in this country.
You're saying a farmer's a negatively perceived person?
Ask Michael Bloomberg. Anybody could be a farmer. I mean, you know, in our circles, farmers have some sort of respect. In outside circles, where people aren't food oriented or otherwise, we're just, you know, we're just dirt-covered workers. And I see it all the time. You know, I don't, you know, we don't get dressed up to go to town or anything, but farmers are not necessarily revered in this country as they were a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, they certainly should be. It's such honorable work, and it's such hard work. I mean, I grow my own vegetables, and I'm blown away sometimes by the amount of time it takes. You know, it's not just planting and harvesting, but then to process it, to clean it, to, you know, package it so that it's going to stay fresh before it goes bad. I mean, it's just, it's huge. And so farmers get all of my respect, unbelievably. And I think they, you know, the more that people realize that all food's not created equal, and the food that organic farmers is doing is such a service not only to their own health but to the environment. As you mentioned, you know, sequestering the carbon, you know, it's helped mitigating climate change, and we need more farmers to be doing that as opposed to adding to climate change.
Yeah.
So it's all,
you know,
big.
The localized aspect of this is important too, right? So people don't, for the most part, people don't even think about their food. They don't even think about where it's coming from, what it exactly is. It's a package. It's like any other good that they purchase, and they throw it in a bag, and they take it home and pop it in the microwave or whatever they're doing and eat it. And I think the opportunity here, as John's saying with COVID, is that you can get localized. You can start to, again, pay a lot of attention, you know, to what it is that you're consuming, because at our essence, that's what we are, right? We are what we eat. And so knowing our farmers, knowing what they're putting in the ground, knowing where that land is, I think is an extremely, it's important for me and my girls and my wife, and I think it's an extremely important aspect of how we should be living in this country.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And how competitive is your model versus like an industrial farming and supply chain model?
Yeah, well, so I think that,
Go ahead, John. What do you want to say?
You know, we can't compete with a feedlot. You know, the way that it's broken down and concentrated, we're not. If we were to try and compete with that, we would lose the essence of what we're doing. And people are willing to pay more for a higher quality product, but because of the co-op model and sharing in the work and equipment and everything that goes into it, we are able to cut the costs to a point where it is reasonable. But it's we would never be able to, nor would we want to try to compete at those levels because, you know, your inputs, your chemicals, your cheap feed, your drugs, your antibiotics, the list that goes on to produce that feed so cheaply is, and that's what I was alluding to before. Like, people realize that that's not the food that they want to be eating. How do we source differently? And it's, and this way you can help change the attitudes of, you know, how people eat. You don't need a supersized Coke. You don't need this big monstrous burger, and you can sit down and have a smaller meal of high quality food, get twice the nutrition. And I've priced it a million. I do this with people all the time when it comes to buying like a chicken and some vegetables at the farmer's market, or going to the McDonald's drive-thru, the difference is so minimal that it would only make sense to make a meal, cook. That crazy mm-hmm. thing, cook your own food.
Absolutely. Well, that's my big MO, is to get people back in the kitchen making their own food. So you're also promoting the growing of hemp. How is the hemp market? And you know, why are you committed to growing hemp? Can you share that with us? Because that's relatively new.
So we have another partner in the business. Her name is Lynn Parodnik. She's probably the most well-known and most prolific, as we call her, our pot doc in the state of New York. She was an OBGYN previously. She came out of, New York City. And so she was the one who really got us started to try and take a look at that, from the standpoint of what the extracts could provide, and, you know, the economies there. And when we first started looking at it, you know, everybody's talking huge numbers and huge business. You grow a acre of this and you're going to become a millionaire. It's the next .com. And, you know, we looked at it closely and didn't really believe that, because at the end of the day, you know, cash crops are cash crops, and they're not going to have, they're going to fall within a certain realm of value. And so, you know, we looked at it closely, but what we found is that with our economies, with the way that we were doing the business, that even with the spot market, you know, where it is right now near the bottom or at the bottom, we're still able to do this competitively, and we're still able to do this the way that we want to do it. Again, it's, you know, organic, it's biodynamic, it's sustainable and regenerable. And so that's done two things for us. One is New York State, in trying to deal with COVID, has blown a hole in the economy. They need to make that up in their budgets. And so we're aligning ourselves to be a co-op, and I think we're the only one, John, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're aligning ourselves to be the only, like, hemp co-op out there in New York State so far that's really applying. And the idea of it is that you're lifting a bunch of ships, you're providing a very clean, sustainable crop that's coming out of family farms. So the state loves it. There's a lot of goodwill there. And then the brands that we work with love to have this as a kind of a backstory for their brands, right? So when they're putting our extracts into their products, it's something that they like to ride along with and like to be able to talk about. And that's why we've gotten into this business. So we think it's something that we can really capitalize on. And beyond extracts, there's a good feed opportunity. There's probably a good, a decent textile opportunity, but I think it's around the feed and the extracts that we're really excited about hemp.
So from the hemp, you're extracting the CBD oil?
CBD and other extracts. And, you know, I actually come out of life sciences. I don't have that background myself, but my wife is a PhD out of Columbia University. We've got friends who are, you know, at NIH, and we're looking at ways to kind of look at the various extracts coming out of hemp and see what are the different combinations and see what the effect of it coming out of the ground itself, right? Because, again, it's really, you know, you look at it from a food standpoint. You look at it from a crop. And then along with Lynn and all of her real-life knowledge and database of patients, so to speak, so there's years and years of knowledge there, we can really, you know, see what we need to grow, how we need to grow it, and what kind of extracts we can provide to our clients. So, yeah, CBD is one, but there's a lot of other ones, too.
And is this the same hemp that would also be turned into fiber? Can you also use the hemp for fiber?
Well, it's two different. That would be the male and female, right, sides of the coin. But, again, what's great about the system is that you don't want to keep those crops together. You can't. But you can have one farm that's doing hemp for extracts, and you can have another farm that's doing it for fiber. And so, you know, that's, again, part of the versatility of the model we have here. It's based around, you know, working with individual farms on specific opportunities.
Uh-huh. Okay, so I didn't realize that they were different, that the female is for the CBD oil and the male would be for the fiber?
Well, there are different strains of hemp, and some are more fibrous, and some grow into a big bush that create more of the bud and more of the CBD content, whereas the fiber plant is a narrower, kind of stalkier plant. So they have different uses. But I think, like, from my perspective with hemp, I'm aligned with all of this healing stuff. But my big thing, I think, with hemp production is it is so underutilized in the United States. We are in the infancy of all different kinds of uses for it, and hemp has a huge, enormous opportunity to replace petroleum-based products. And I think the whole idea, if you're going to green up or fight climate, whatever you want to do, you have to begin to minimize the amount of fracking and oil production, methane producing that goes on in this country, and hemp is a cheap alternative to replacing a lot of petroleum-based products.
Oh, really? Like what? Can you give us an example?
A plastic cup.
Uh-huh.
If you think of a plastic cup, a plastic bottle, anything that is made, anything that is made from plastics can be made from hemp. It's not just about running cars. It is this whole chain of stuff that doesn't biodegrade. That stuff is petroleum based and not necessarily the best thing to drink out of. Utensils, bowls, otherwise. I mean, there is just multiple uses, you know, for hemp that are just, we're not touching it here in this country because of the strength of, you know, the oil lobbies.
Yeah. Yeah, well, my daughter did a report on it back years ago when she was in college and found out that, you know, the whole thing around hemp and trying to make marijuana illegal really was pushed by DuPont because it was competition to their cotton. And that was really the reason that hemp became illegal was because of the cotton market way back when.
Yeah. And to have something be illegal that, like, that doesn't even get you high, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's no impairment, there's nothing to really make it illegal,
that's when you have to smell money.
Yeah. And the other advantage we're going to see out of this now, too, and John will have much more detail, but essentially, if you look at hemp from a feed standpoint, the nutritional impact and the type of health it provides to the animals is tremendous. But on top of that, you can, again, localize it. And so it's locally grown by farms for their local herds. And that is an offset to what's going on with all this non-GMO soy and corn that's essentially burning up the planet, right? The acres and acres, thousands and thousands of acres of this that's just being grown to feed animals, and it's just a chemical desert. And so that's another opportunity that we see as being something that we can capitalize on.
Amazing. Well, it sounds like you guys have your hands in many things, and, you know, I look forward to, you know, staying on top of what you're doing and watching your co-op grow, because what excites me about it is that it is scalable, that, you know, it really has the potential of growing, and then it seems to me like it is a great model for other areas to take up as well, because just in Absolutely. General, I mean, does it make sense for every farm to have all that of their own expensive equipment when you can share it, you know? I mean, you know, it's the same in, you know, the basis of so many co-ops. I mean, working cooperatively with other people to reduce your expenses just makes sense all across the board. So,
yeah, absolutely.
What's next for your organization now? We're just about at the end, so I want to just wrap that up so you can share, and then we'll share the contact so that people can find you.
Okay, great. I mean, we're mid season right now, and we're waiting to get to the harvest and get our products to our clients and start moving into next year where we can expand out the operation and bring some more farms on board and as John said, we're looking at various data models. I've got a close friend out of IBM who's an AI expert, and he's helping us to look at how AI can actually impact what family farms are doing and how we're working on it. You know, there's a lot of moving parts, as you said, a lot of different things we're doing. And so that's kind of where we're focused. We're focused on really establishing this and moving to the next stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's wonderful. I want to thank you both for joining me today. It's been so informative. I'll share your contact information on my website. But basically, people can go to agfamiliar.com to find out more information. And, John, I'll also share your contacts for the August West Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture that you're running, and Great. Your own farm and outpost. So thank you both for joining me. It's been wonderful. And everybody out there, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. See you all again next week. Bye.